100.3 K-Talk Podcast. Darkness Radio with Dave Schrader. Weeknights from 9 to midnight on 100.3 K-Talk.
Good evening. It's Tuesday, September 7th. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Mally Fox. Good evening, Mally.
Good evening.
We've got some interesting shows coming up. We're actually going to spend two nights with our next guests, tonight and tomorrow night. And then we're off on Thursday because we are the FM home for the Minnesota Vikings. And, of course, they got their big kickoff game that's starting this Thursday. So while Mally and I are out in Mansfield, Ohio, with the Ghost Adventures guys, I'm going to figure out some way to stream KFan or KTalk so I could listen to the show right off the website. And you can do that and listen like on the iHeartRadio application. Mm-hmm. But Thursday night, of course, the Minnesota Vikings will be here. Friday night, we'll be back with Chris Alexander from Fangoria Magazine talking about why do people like horror movies? What's the background in horror? And we're going to do that. But tonight, this was an intriguing book that was sent to me. And I wanted to have this gentleman on with us, and he's actually lined up a few special guests that he's bringing with him. Nigel Kerner is an author and freelance journalist, born in Sri Lanka, his mother from a British planting family, and his father an officer in the British Royal Navy Fleet Air Arm. This international family base provided the background for an obsessive and serious interest in international human affairs and how these interface with science, religion, and philosophy. He's felt driven from his young years to expose the humbug and hypocrisy in modern scientific and religious and social thinking. His formal graduate education is in biomedical science and human behavioral psychology. His fascination with the puzzling and enigmatic phenomena of UFOs resulted in his first book, The Song of the Greys, which was published by Hodder and Stoughton in 1997. Very serious work on the subject is now noted worldwide for its radical view on the phenomena. His latest book, Grey Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, which was published by Inner Traditions Bearing Company, is the second in a trilogy about the UFO phenomena and its social repercussions on humanity. His books and numerous articles have been established his unique thesis as part of the canon of serious literature on this subject. So it's a real pleasure for us to have him on all the way. Now, Mr. Kerner, are you out in England? Is that correct?
Yes, yes. We're talking to you from England.
Okay. Well, welcome to the show, sir. Thank you for spending your late evening here with us. We appreciate you giving us some time.
Great pleasure. Great pleasure today.
Now, I want to start off by talking to you a little bit about your background and then your first book. Now, having a fascination and getting as deep into this as you have in your life, was there a key moment for you? Did you have a viewing or a sighting yourself in youth of a UFO?
No. The whole thing started rather harmlessly when my 12-year-old son asked me a question about UFOs. He's a pretty sharply dressed up kid, this boy of mine, and he asked me if the UFO phenomenon was real. And since he would come at me with some incredible, you know, juxtapositions of mind and so on, I had to be on the ball, so to speak, in answering him. And I decided not to give him a flippant answer and say, look, my first instinct was to say this was all absolute nonsense and it was all Mickey Mouse stuff and whatever. But I thought I'd better actually delve into the background of it before I answered him. And 37 years later, from being totally cynical about this phenomenon, I have been turned upside down, life-changing discoveries that based the entire ethos in a situation that prevails, I think, for all humanity. And so it kind of, you know, made me kind of dedicate the rest of my living and earning potential in terms of, you know, trying to get some kind of truth here from all the various lines of that this huge subject seemed to follow, and that's how I got into it, really, basically, on the question of a 12-year-old boy. And, my colleague...
And it only took you 37 years to give him an answer? Or
Well, no one ever gets the final answer on most things in this world, as you know, Dave, but the fact is that there's some interesting lines to follow when one connects up the dots, and that's the real problem, is that, you know, what do we do if there is such a thing as an answer to this huge question? And it's been a kind of, you know, very, very, very interesting exercise over the years, really.
Now, you said you started off very cynical with this, and believe me,
I did.
It was just, you know, yes, for fun and getting out there. At what stage in your research did you start to scratch your head and think, wow, there's maybe a lot more going into this than I thought?
Yeah, well, it's quite clear. I mean, as you went along and you looked at all the anecdotal evidence and all the other kinds of, you know, most of it's anecdotal, of course, and also the little bits of the actual physical evidence that many people tend to dismiss, one began to see that the veracity of the people that were witnessing all of this and were experiencing all of this were too, shall we say, well-heeled, well set up to be liars and cheats and so on. And there was so much of it that the volume was so huge that, in fact, I wondered, you know, look, unless the whole world is built of lies, there has to be some incredible thing going on here. And as we went along year after year, looking at it from more or less, you know, into a test tube. My background, as I say, is science, and obviously one is I've been used to the scientific method all my life. And looking at it through these kinds of, you know, the verification processes, the methodology of science, rather than just grabbing at the latest principle, the latest idea, the latest subjective thesis, whatever, one has to actually look at this and sort the whole thing out. And in doing that, the thing stood up so well that I began to get more and more fascinated that we had something extremely important going on here, if not, you know, and the conclusion that I've come to in the last 30-odd years of dedicated research into this and writing about it and so on, is that we have here the greatest secret that mankind has ever not told, so to speak, and something ought to be done about this, because there seems to be some kind of mechanism here that wants to keep this wonderful revelation. And in the end, it turns out to be a great and heartening revelation, even though in some instances, as I went along the way, absolutely made me despair, discovering that, you know, there's some huge entity here that might have crossed galaxies, come over here, and is farming the human race, which was the actual, you know, final consensus I came to when we're looking at all these lines together. And, of course, I, you know, discussed this with various friends of mine and various people that had expertise in this. Amongst them, two of my most distinguished pals in this are Dr. Andrew Silverman, who's a medical doctor, and Professor John Biggerstaff, who works over there in the States in Tennessee. And we've crossed swords about this for many, many years, and I think we've come to a consensus that something very, very strange is going on in the state of Denmark, so to speak, you know.
Now, you've actually brought them on, and they're going to be joining us in a few minutes here. I'm curious. It seems the European view of UFOs and aliens seems a lot more open than we are here in the United States. I mean, you've got England has come forth and given a lot of their information. France is releasing it. Even Canada, Russia, they've all come forward and given these bits of information. And you know, they've released a lot more than the United States, in my opinion.
I think, Dave, that probably is due to the fact that the Americans tend to be very devotional in their religious precepts. And the incredibly surprising thing I found when investigating what I thought was a totally secular phenomenon is how this whole business ties up with religion. And that is the thing that, in fact, jumped up at me as something totally unusual and fascinating. And, of course, once we actually had to, we extrapolated all these various lines of answers coming in about it and then put it together, we began to see a manifestation here of something absolutely out of this world in the sense it's sensational and mostly fascinating in terms of explaining the main attitudes of human beings in terms of religion, sociology, and the whole spectrum of that existential platform that we all as human beings have to follow, you know. And the point is that when we saw how beautifully this blended in with something, I mean, for instance, the title of the book says, it wasn't my choice, of course it was a marketing choice from my publisher, but when you see the title on the face of it, it sounds absolutely ludicrous that, you know, we're talking about soul here and UFOs and what on earth is the connection. But the fascinating thing is when we stitch it up, and I hope to be able to try and do that in 2 hours to some extent for you guys, you begin to see that we have here in the midst of us something that every single, I would say, with respect, that every single human being ought to be interested in and ought to be given a chance to be interested in, because the repercussions are absolutely huge for us all.
You mentioned the fact that you think that it might have a lot to do with our religious ties here. Do you think that the Catholic Church is opening us up for that? I mean, with the response that came out, I think 2 years ago it was, with the Pope saying that it was no longer a sin or wrong for us to believe in alien life or life on other planets. Do you think that that was the Church's way of saying there's something coming and we're starting to prepare the people for that?
I have no idea. I mean, I would never second-guess a pope, but I would say this to you.
There's probably been a couple you should have second-guessed, Nigel.
I have to say that somebody splashed some water on me when I was a child and called me a Christian, and it took me a long time to recover from the organized part of that, but that right. doesn't mean to say I don't believe in the old man of Jerusalem, as I call him, a wondrous being that actually came and started it all, who's been lied against and vilified and all the terrible things done in the name of an organized capacity. And, of course, Dr. Silberman is of Jewish extraction. He has a very interesting take on this Shroud of Turin business, an expert in that. He had a recent paper at one of the most distinguished scientific seminars on the latest evidence in the Shroud in Frascati in Italy, and he's got some very interesting conclusions he's come to. And of course, Dr. Biggestaff, who is in biochemistry and in terms of DNA and so on, an expert in his own right, and how we can try and tie all of this. I hope the science is not too obscure. We tried to do our best not to make it too kind of scientific and so on, but I think that people might well be interested in how these lines converge, you know, Dave. And let's hope that we can get the things kind of deployed properly so there's a kind of single line running through it and people don't get too confused.
Well, that's my hope. I'm going to yield to your hyper-intelligence over my Cro-Magnon approach here, and feel free to drag this interview any way you want it to go so that we can get the most information out. I'm certainly interested, and I want to talk with your other guests that you've got with you. And you said now Dr. Biggestaff is the American-based doctor. Is that correct?
Of English extraction, but he works in America at the University of Tennessee.
Okay, boy, that's quite a jaunt for getting yes. to work every day, isn't it?
Well, John, can you come in? Can you come in, John?
Yes, I actually live in Knoxville, so it's quite close to the university.
Yes, I can hear that southern accent mm-hmm. you've got now.
Little twang.
Yeah, it didn't. You know, I never got used to it.
Well, you've been over here for how long, Dr. Biggestaff?
About 15 years.
Okay, and have
spent
you
about 8 years in Florida and about 7 years in Tennessee.
Coming into the United States and working here now, did you have an interest in UFOs and that phenomena prior to coming to the United States?
Well, I've always had an interest in UFOs and the paranormal, et cetera, because I've always been of the belief, really, in science. I've trained my life in science. There really are the limits that are set on scientific endeavor and discovery are rather fickle because, you know, people discover things sometimes and they're vilified for it, and later on we find out that it was all correct. And so I've really sort of not tried to adhere to the boundaries, but tried to be open about as many subjects as I could. And so I've always been interested in UFOs. And when I read Nigel's first book, I questioned him on some of the points there. And gradually, in a process of my own discovery, I went and checked a lot of these things scientifically. And I'm quite convinced that Nigel's got an absolutely astounding hypothesis here.
Well, let me start with your background a little bit as well. Where do you come from in the medical world? What is your forte?
Well, my background, I was originally trained as a medical laboratory technician, and then I went to do a degree in medical biochemistry, and I have a diploma in cellular immunology and a PhD in cell biology and biochemistry.
Well, when you read the first book, which Nigel had published, which was entitled The Song of the Greys, what stood out to you that you questioned the most out of the information he conveyed in that book?
Well, I mean, he was coming up with an awful lot of things to do with genetic interception, for instance, by these aliens, etc. And although my subject is cell biology, I know a little bit of the molecular biology to do with that. And when I checked up on all of these things, he mentions the use, for instance, of ultraviolet light in manipulating DNA, and the fact that the little powerhouses of the cell called mitochondria, which appeared, in conventional science, it's considered that these little oil cell actually may have just accidentally come into the cells from bacteria. The problem is that we can't find what these bacteria are, even in fossil records, etc. And Nigel's idea that these things may have been constructed as vectors to actually put influence into us in terms of a genetic change still stand as a valid hypothesis.
Well, Nigel, let's talk a little bit about the first book. When you with the Song of the Greys, what were you trying to bring out in the first book? What was your intent for that book to start off this trilogy?
First, the verifications that these people were making. There were so many important individuals that were coming out and saying that these UFOs are real, that they weren't to be brushed under the carpet. You made the point about the Europeans being more open about UFOs and that the Americans tend to close shop about it. I think there's a religious reason for this. The Americans are much more kind of devotional in the sense of their worship practices and so forth, whereas the Europeans tend to come from a bunch of pagans to start. If I may say so with respect. However, they're a little bit more secular in their outlook, a little bit more open-minded, and can actually look at things. And that's the whole point, you see, David, is you really got to look at this thing with as balanced and open a stance as possible. Because if you come with your prejudices hitched up to your eyes or wherever, you're never going to get anywhere in anything, really. So I try to make a neutral consensus happen when I took all these facts before me. And when you get astronauts and when you get individuals that are heads of military units and so on coming and verifying the fact that these things are actually here, they were actually taken out of these modules they call flying discs or whatever, and you hear their testimony and you see their testimony for you in so many verifications that you get on television. And I don't need to labor the point, because if anyone wants to know about this, it's out there. There's some thousands and thousands and thousands of cases of this, pilots and doctors and lawyers and priests and people with, one would have thought, and police officers and so on, one would have thought, with people with a sense of integrity and responsibility bearing witness to all of this, one had to accept that there was a genuine phenomenon on our planet. Now, if you accept that, the moment you do that, you've got a huge barrier against what science is discovering through, you know, Einstein and the mechanical universe of Newton and so on. And you've got this, you know, equals MC squared business, which actually puts before us a limit to the speed, to what we can travel the vast distances of space. And out there are billions of these stars. So how on earth would anything get to our planet? Never mind, you know, anything else. And one had to look at how these mechanisms would work and how physics was developing and making some kind of postulation as to how these distances may be negotiated. But then you set that quite simply against the kind of the logic that says our civilization is maybe 200 years old in terms of industrialization and that kind of thing. And what about a civilization that might be there, as many of our scientists are now putting the theory forward, that they might be there for a million years? Now, how on earth can we, in our tiny developmental aegis as a species, ally that particular thing against, you know, something that might be have been there for so long, discovering exponentially huge and wonderful, mechanisms that science might be able to use to subvert this business about, a limited speech. So, in fact, we could bring the universe to us was the final consensus I came to quite simply. And if that's the case, then we have a problem. If these things are here, they would be so superior against our own aegis, so to speak, as human beings. How on earth are we going to manage them? They are obviously going to manage us, because whenever you've got a superior mechanism looking after an inferior one, the superior one dominates the inferior one. And you've only got the example of, Columbus and the United States of America.
Well, that's
true. Of course, the Native Americans didn't do too well there, did they?
No.
So the point... So the problem there is that how do we deal with this situation where a superior intelligence would in fact come and look after whatever they want to look after? Their own interests would be first and foremost. And if that's the case, we have a problem, because we would be the people that they would dominate. And if that's the case, what are we? Have we been made in their likeness? Or are we independent in an ecclesiastical sense, as we tend to take it in religious kinds of ways of saying things, if you see what I'm trying to say? And the point is that if they dominate us, where is the domination? How do we see it? What are the lines that we can derive to actually trace this and to look at this as cogently and as neutrally and as non-subjectively as possible, to look at it as objectively as possible and come to some kind of consensus on it? And once I did that and I began to trace these lines in that kind of fashion, well, you opened a huge can of worms there, and there's an incredible story to tell that might in fact concern each and every one of us. Because if we are being dominated by something else, what is that something else? Now, if you've got to negotiate space, and you've got to come these vast distances, and you've got to do that beyond the speed of light, you've also got to decelerate when you come to a particular location. If you have to do that, and you're a living biological entity, such as us or any biological entity, you will be a stain on the window when you decelerate with that kind of, gravitational mark, so to speak. You've got a problem. You will be a stain on the windowsill of your whatever craft you're in. So it had to be that whatever was here may well be a contrived mechanism, like a machine, some kind of biological machine. So I make the summation that maybe these things are roboids. I did this in 97 in Song of the Greys. And if they are roboids, they would have to be constructed in such a way they could withstand the deceleration, inertial forces, and so forth, in such a way. And of course, looking at the evidence and delving into it from the archives in the Soviet Union once it collapsed and so forth, and talking to various people, sources of mine and so forth, I came to the conclusion that they were a type of being that was made in a particular fashion to be able to do this. And that would make them a robot, a robotic mind. Not natural, didn't come in with the universe as we all did.
Right, but you feel that these are manufactured to do the job that they're doing.
Absolutely. So okay. They're manufactured, they're in the universe, manufactured within it, and we, because we're natural and we have a derivational right. line, therefore going right back to the beginning of the universe, we are rather special here.
And so we have to take a quick break, Nigel. We'll come back, and I want to talk indeed. To you more about this. Our guest, Nigel Kerner, also along with us, John Biggerstaff and Andrew Silverman. We're going to be speaking with them as well. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio, Monday through Friday, 11 p.m. till midnight, right here on 100.3 K-Talk. Good evening. Welcome back to the show. This is Darkness Radio. We are your home for the best in paranormal talk radio. Every weeknight you can tune in as we explore monsters, myths, and legends. I was going to suddenly talk like Daffy Duck there. Monsters, myths, and legends. This evening we're talking with our guest, Nigel Kerner, who has authored the book The Song of the Greys, and the new book, Grey Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. Also joining Nigel Kerner, we have John Biggerstaff and Andrew Silverman. Before the commercial break, Nigel, you're bringing up the fact that these traveling beings making this long trek and going at what we would have to believe to be insanely accelerated speeds would, as you mentioned, have to eventually decelerate. They'd have to slow down. And a biological, you believe, would just end up splattering against that windshield. And you believe that that might show reasons why these creatures are more of a biological, mechanical being. I'm curious, absolutely. Have you heard of the work of John Searle?
I have heard of it. I'm not too familiar with the whole ethos. But I have my sources have been people a little bit more open to this kind of thing. When the Soviet Union opened its doors and China got a little bit more liberal than it used to be, shall right. we say, we've got scientists and so on giving us their outlook and their kind of discoveries about this whole phenomenon. And from looking at all the information there and speaking to individuals within their framework, it seems that these things are made of a kind of mercury mulch, the chemical mercury mulch with gold wires and intricately strewn in within their nature or whatever, and they have obviously the things that we're discovering now, in fact, transistors and diodes and all the rest of it made of biological material, and that in fact they are, as I say, I call them roboids, but they're bioids, really, biological mechanistic beings that have an intelligence factorization that's made from artificial intelligence. And that means it's a kind of add-on intelligence as they go along and so forth. So they operate on a program. And that is essentially the philosophical conundrum and difference that provides all the interest for all the things I have to say, both in Song of the Great and in the new book, is that what on earth happens when you've got the interplay of such an enormous intelligence, quantum intelligence, against our own, and how we in our own natural state of derivation from the beginning of the universe interplay that kind of factorization with their kind of outlook, as could be expected from a computerized artificial intelligent being. And so when you look at those two things, one has to say there is such a contrast. What would they expect from us, and how would we have to react to them? Now, it seems to me that...
Well, dude, could I ask real quickly? I mean, we're presupposing then that they're traversing the galaxies, the universe, to get to our planet. Have you put thought into, is it maybe not the universe or the galaxy, but alternate dimensions or other dimensions that they're traveling from and between, and why we might not be showing life on those planets that we're trying to scope out there? We'll find them because they're here and they're popping in and out from wherever they're coming from.
Wherever they're coming from, yes. The point is that wherever their origin point, it might be it interdimensional or whether it is in fact in our galaxy or the universe itself, we still have to deal with an actual physical entity here. Mm-hmm. And that is the proposition that I was looking at, because one can speculate where they might come from and how they might make their observations and carry out their processes and so on. But the very fact that we are dealing here with a physical entity, this is actually a physical proposition where we're looking at. And this particular thing, therefore, has to be taken on in our terms of our physical terms of reference. However, we know that we might be physical in body, but we also have something that's abstract and wondrous. We think, there we are, we've got something that is not of this world. And so we have to then understand, how does thinkability come into it? How does conscience and consciousness come into these things? And so you see, David, a whole framework opens up of all these other, if you like, marginalizations that we have to look at in terms of dealing with something that might be completely not of our world, so to speak, yet within our world perspectives. And so looking at the Greys in their terms of reference, we have to try to find out, you know, surely is it more realistic that a physical phenomenon such as the Greys is on this physical dimension? It's much more likely to be that this interaction is taking place in our physical dimensional terms. And of course it might be from another dimension. That may well be true. But then thought might be seen as another dimensional expression too.
Well, and that, you know, that's interesting to me. You mentioned too about the fact of being part mechanical, part biomedical, if you will. The a lot of the people that have had experiencers or abductees, however you want to term them, mentioned that a lot of times the communication seems to be of a telepathic nature between them. Which, if they were mechanical in nature, and like what we know of the broadband and being able to communicate now wirelessly, it could just be the conveyance of information that way from one another. That certainly gives me pause to think about it as well. As you know, I mean, that may be understandable some people can, you know, they're able to instantly understand what's going on when they're in these situations with these aliens.
Absolutely. But you see, that's a very, very difficult thing in terms the subjective side of it comes into it. And you get all kinds of accusations being made that it's your own personal opinions and whatever. And there's no externally manifestable mechanism for identifying it objectively, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Sure.
But I think that the proposition that I was trying to make, just purely looking at it from the physical stance, so to speak, may well be seen and looked at in terms of the biology as we know it now. And this is where Dr. Biggerstaff's expertise comes in. How do we actually construct a mechanism of communication via the genetic factors that make us all up? And if they, being physical beings, have an incredible intelligence on how this might be done, it may well be the thing that explains why suddenly, about 250,000 years ago, we all suddenly develop a massive brain and, more important than that, a massive pair of hips to admit that brain into life from nowhere, when for 3 or 4 million years before we've been a kind of humanoid that's been going out, so to speak, into some kind of monkey, and yet suddenly we become Homo sapiens sapiens. Now, it seems to me that genetic engineering would be a wonderful way of seeing that that is put to a halt and something else might prevail out of this. And so then I try to look at the likelihood this might be so. I had to look at this and through all the current research into DNA and so forth. And of course, Dr. Biggerstaff has been a great help in winding our way through all the intricacies and so on. And I think we've got to a situation where maybe there is a plausible I claim no more than maybe. Maybe there's a plausible way in this construct and might have happened and be taken to some kind of intelligent summation. And I think that's really the exciting thing about all of this. If, in fact, we are being genetically engineered, if, in fact, we are a lab rat for these people, what is their motive? What have we got that they want so much that they're prevailing for millennia on this planet? And I think the discovery of what we might be as human beings and what is precious about our humanity was probably the greatest thing of all in this entire adventure of mine in trying to look at this question, to discover how unique and wonderful a human being really might truly be, something we don't quite, I think, nominally appreciate in our day-to-day lives in this world. So there's something to say about that too. And I think Dr. Silverman has a very erudite position on this, and it'd be wonderful to see this. And you know, it then connects up with the Shroud of Turin and whatever this individual they call Yeshua ben Joseph in Jewish terms, but we call commonly Jesus Christ, might well have been here on this planet in some kind of capacity to warn all of us that there is an artificial side of this universe of ours that is extremely dangerous, and that we have to all take notice. If ever we are hit by such a thing, we all have to take notice that this thing might be, in fact, a great danger to any natural species that are derived out of the natural consensus of the universe from the Big Bang coming forward to the present time.
All right, we've got with us this evening Nigel Kerner, and you can check out his website at nigelkerner.com. That's nigelkerner.com is a website. You can find information, his biography. You can find information on both of the books that are out. And we do have that link on our site as well. If you go to darknessradio.com and click on the show schedule there, you'll be able to find information on our guests this evening. And they'll be joining us again tomorrow night, as you see. Shows are wrapping up very fast on us here. We're going to take a break in a minute, and we'll come back. We have about another 10 minutes, 11 minutes with our guests this evening. Excuse me. And we want to get as in-depth into this as we possibly can over these two evenings on the show. We're going to also be joined when we come back from the break with John Biggerstaff and Andrew Silverman to get some of the input and their take on the subject as well. The name of the book, The Song of the Greys, is the first part of the trilogy. Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls is the second book that is out right now. Again, all that information can be found on nigelkerner.com. Stay tuned. More of the best in paranormal talk radio continues in just moments with Mally Fox and Dave Schrader right here, Darkness Radio 100.3 K-Talk. Good evening. Welcome back to the show, another show burning by. This is Tuesday night, September 7th, and you're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. Do me a favor, keep your dial right here, because right after Darkness Radio, you can hear George Norrie and Coast to Coast as he continues a journey into the strange and unusual. Then you can talk about strange and unusual. We got Chris Baker every morning, and you can tune in and check him out on 100.3 K-Talk. And don't forget, this Thursday, the Vikings kick off right here on your FM home for the Minnesota Vikings, 100.3 K-Talk. Our guests this evening, Nigel Kerner, and we're talking about his books, A Song of the Greys and Grey Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. We've been talking to Nigel primarily here during the first hour with a brief introduction to John Biggerstaff. And now I'd like to also bring into the show, Nigel, can you give us an introduction for Andrew Silverman?
Yeah, this is Dr. Andrew Silverman, who's a medical doctor, and he's got an expertise on this wonderful artifact that they seem to have come up with, the Shroud of Turin, where he gave a philosophical lecture on the meaning of this object at Frascati in Italy in a recent symposium with all the latest big scientific names considering the evidence for the veracity of this object. So Andrew's here with me at the moment.
Hi.
Good evening, Andrew. Thank you very much for joining us, sir. And I'm intrigued to see how this is brought together. I purposely keep myself out of the loop of reading too much in because I want to ask the questions my listeners are going to have. And if I educate myself too much on a topic, it seems I forget to ask those important questions. But coming in and talking about the Shroud of Turin and its connection with UFOs and aliens, I know it's got a lot of us scratching our head, and I'd love to hear your theories on what's going on with this and what information you have regarding the Shroud of Turin.
Certainly. Well, for those listeners who don't know too much about it, I should just say a brief introduction about the Shroud. It's a piece of cloth which is kept in Turin in Italy, hence the name, which is totally unique in all the historical and archaeological artifacts that we have on this planet, or even modern technological artifacts, in that it's a piece of cloth with a photographic negative imprint on the surface fibers with what the scientists call distance-coded holographic information in it. Now, it was discovered in the late 19th century when Secunda Pia, who was an early photographer, was commissioned to take a photograph of the Shroud, and he nearly fainted when he saw the negative as part of the process of doing so. The negative of the Shroud is a perfect positive because the Shroud itself is a negative. And this is, many scientists believe this is a clue to how the image got there, that actually the only consistent way they have of explaining how it got there is that the dead body that the Shroud wrapped actually shone brighter than the sun for a tiny, tiny fraction of a second to actually change the molecular structure of the surface fibers of this cloth to imprint the image upon it in such a way that cannot be replicated even using 21st century technology. Now, it's fascinating to try to account for what my talk was about at Frascati, was discussing various speculations about how that could happen. Why would a dead body shine brighter than the sun? Now, to understand this, it seems to me that you have to look at what is humanity. What was it that made that particular individual so unique that he was capable of doing this? Or the question that I put to people was: is the point that he was that unique, or is there something that we can learn from what he did that informs us about our huge capacity and potential that we all have as human beings? Now, if I could sidestep this for a moment, just a very brief diversion that I introduced at this talk. You'll hopefully see the relevance later. When I was a student over 20 years ago, a medical student, and I was in Scotland, there was an inaugural lecture by one of the first professors of parapsychology that had just been appointed in Edinburgh, and he came to give a talk about what they call PSI, PSI, as in mind over matter, extrasensory perception. And his talk was basically looking at the evidence: does this exist or doesn't this exist? And he was showing that there is quite a bit of evidence that these things happen. But then at the end of the talk, there was question time. I just put my hand up and said, in raising my hand, I have proved, at least to myself, that mind over matter is real. You see, mm-hmm. Each of us all the time, we're using our free will every single moment of the day. And that is That is mind over matter. What else is free will but mind over matter? And it's fascinating when you actually look at what would be the scientific implications if science were to accept that free will is real and not just an artifact of the way that we look at things, but an actual real phenomenon. And it ties into what discoveries that were made around about 80 years ago or so in quantum theory, where they found that actually matter at the subatomic level, and therefore at all levels, is only real because it's observed. And it can only be observed by a conscious observer. So a closed-circuit video recorder filming it doesn't make it real. It's when the person looks at that image later. It sounds bizarre, but you can actually, this is actually experimentally verifiable that consciousness does have a role in making reality real. And actually, Schrödinger, one of the pioneers of quantum theory, had made some fascinating conclusions from this. The first is that what we do as observers, as conscious sentient observers, is to make such a moment that we call now. That the whole universe, all of time, beginning and end and everything would all be all one, all together, but we single out a moment that we call now. And in doing so, we make time happen. And his point was that because we have made time, time cannot unmake us. In other words, that anything that has this capacity to be able to be sentient and to know and to observe, it has to be eternal. It has no beginning and no end. And the fascinating thing about free will, if it exists, if we see the future as what hasn't yet been determined, then free will sits at the interface between past, present, and future. Now, the other point that he saw is that actually the thing that we call mind in all of us is actually the same basic quality. It's just different in terms, it's defined in terms of what we're aware of and what we choose. We each have different memories and experiences and we make different choices, but fundamentally the background state of awareness and knowing, if you like, is the same for all of us. And in fact, if you look at the origin of the universe, the whole thing came out of, it's believed by science, a singularity, that everything was all one in a kind of perfectly balanced nothingness, if you like, all together, no space, no time, and no matter. Now, if we didn't have a beginning, then we must have already been there then, which means that we were all one then. And the postulation is perhaps that when Hawking says that, you know, it doesn't take God to light the blue touch paper to actually start the universe, maybe in the sense all sentient being has made the universe, not God deciding to throw us into it, but we have actually made it happen ourselves, that we have actually chosen to separate. Now, I'm bringing this, tying this back into the shroud. The all the evidence points this to this individual who formed that image, equating to be the same person as the historical character that we know as Jesus, or as Nigel was saying, Yeshua ben Yosef, it would have been how he might have been known in Hebrew at the time. Now, the very fascinating thing about this individual is that he's one of the people in the whole of history who has made the most impact on human history, and he did it through what he taught and how he lived, how he practiced what he taught, which was this idea of loving your neighbor as yourself. Now, I don't want to go all religious and poetical here. I want to see how this relates to reason, logic, and science. As I say, I have no vested interest in this, coming from a Jewish background myself. But if Schrödinger was right, that we are fundamentally all one, we came from the same source, and that we have separated and that our separation has made the physical universe happen, then perhaps that is how we've become atomic, material, physical beings, that we've actually become caught through our restrictions that keep us different, separate from each other, because we're not all-knowing, we're not perfectly free, because we have restrictions that separate us, be they racism, nationalism, selfishness, ego, arrogance, whatever, jealousy. All these are properties that limit the mind, that restrict the mind. And what people like Jesus and the Buddha and many others have taught is a way that you can rationally undo that by seeing the huge, immense value of all humanity, so that you don't have to try to have an inferiority complex of yourself as being something less, but see your own grandeur and therefore that of all others. Now, if perhaps, if a life lived in such a way, could actually reverse the momentum that originally made matter happen out of nothingness. Now, it's believed that at the Big Bang, there was originally nothing, and then light, and then matter. Now, Nigel's hypothesis that really inspired me when I read it, and it's actually a manuscript that he wrote even before Song of the Greys, which I'm hoping will get published at some stage, is that...
Well, you know, we're going to have to hold here. We've got to end tonight's show. It's done, okay. Unfortunately, but we'll come back tomorrow, and will all three of you join me again tomorrow? We can finish talking about
Definitely.
This? Great.
Absolutely, yes.
All right, fantastic. Stay tuned, guys. I'm sorry we don't have any more time tonight's show, but come back with us tomorrow. Fascinating subject, and we're going to be talking with our guests, Nigel Kerner, Andrew Silverman, and John Biggerstaff. Stay tuned. George Norrie and Coast to Coast continues right here on 100.3 K-Talk. Darkness Radio will be back tomorrow night right here, same time, 11 p.m. till midnight on 100.3 K-Talk.
100.3 K-Talk Podcast. Darkness Radio with Dave Schrader. Weeknights from 9 to midnight on 100.3 K-Talk.